You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello and welcome to Locked On Cavaliers, your daily look at LeBron James and the rest of the always interesting Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm Chris Manning, your host at FearTheSword.com. Today's show is a breakdown of Game 5 with Jeff Siegel. He's a writer at FearTheSword.com. Peachtree Hoops, Early Bird Rights, The Step Back, a whole bunch of awesome places, and you can support his work on Patreon as well at patreon.com/earlybirdrights. Go do that. He has a bunch of cool rewards, and the insight you're going to get from supporting him, I think, is really worth it. We talked about his piece about, that he wrote at Fear the Sword about the Cavs hunting down Terry Rozier, about Thompson and Nance's play, about Kevin Love's play, and about Hood, Osman, and Jordan Clarkson's statuses right now. Today's show also has a clip that you're going to hear now about Trae Young, the Oklahoma guard and the player many have mocked to the Cavs at number 8 in the upcoming NBA draft. Matt Schock, the host of Locked On Pistons, was at the draft combine, and the clip you're going to hear right now is what Trae Young said when asked about his relationship with LeBron James and that. It's not a ton of information, but anyway, here is Trae Young.
Do you think you're the best scorer in this draft?
I think I'm the best overall player in this draft. But my main focus isn't necessarily to be the best player in this draft. My goal is to be the best player in the NBA, and that's what I'm focusing on each and every day.
You have a relationship with LeBron. Has he talked to you about this process at all? And the Cavs are slotted at number 8, and that's the spot that mocks have you going at sometimes.
I mean, right now he's trying to win an Eastern Conference Finals.
Right.
So he's very busy. But he's, I mean, obviously he says some things, good things about me this year. LeBron is someone who, I mean, he's changed the game, a big role model as far as on and off the court, the way he handles himself in every situation is something that I really like about LeBron.
So there's Trae Young. At Fear the Sword, Trevor Magnotti is going to have a bunch more coming about the NBA draft in the coming weeks. His first big draft breakdown is coming on Trae Young. It is going to be up in the next day or so, up at FearTheSword.com. Trae Young is also on Trevor's big board that he did, his Cavs-specific big board. You can find that in the show notes as well as Jeff's piece on Terry Rozier. But look for that Trae Young piece in the coming days, and he's someone we're going to be talking about, I'm sure, a lot in the next month or so. But here's today's show with Jeff Siegel. Be sure to find Locked On Cavaliers on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave that 5-star rating and review, and we'll be back tomorrow with another recap of a Cavs game with a look at Game 5 and what that game leads in for the Cavs as the series gets closer and closer to a finish. Cheers, y'all. Jeff, let's start with Terry Rozier. You wrote a really good piece up at FearTheSword.com. People can read that piece. It's in the show notes of this podcast as well. If you're listening on FearTheSword.com or LockedOnCavaliers.com, it is linked in the post with the podcast in it. The Cavs, I thought the most noticeable thing they did in Game 4 offensively was really hunt down Terry Rozier. They did whatever they could to get post-ups against Rozier inside. That was a lot of the time LeBron James. That was also Kevin Love. But you also saw Tristan Thompson do it. I thought he did a good job of taking advantage of those situations. And then you had Jeff Green do it, and Jeff Green was the one guy, unsurprisingly, I guess, who sort of bungled it. But this was a very blunt strategy by the Cavs. It's something that I think makes a lot of sense for them to exploit. Boston did come up with some different options to deal with it to varying degrees of effectiveness, and I would argue that with some of the scramming they were doing off ball to get Rozier away from this, the Cavs are going to find ways around that, I think, going forward. You saw hints of that in Game 4. But what to you stood out about how the Cavs just went after Rozier and so kind of over and over again it just kept going back to that well?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to see that they went back to that well over and over, and they went back to it in lots of different ways. Like you said, there were four different guys who really posted up or ISO'd against him. There were a bunch of different ways that they got into that action, whether James was the ball handler or George Hill, and then they threw it into James or Love or Thompson. And I think the possessions, the handful of possessions where James was the ball handler, those are the ones that are the most instructive, because that's where the Cavaliers had their most success. So those are the ones that they're going to go back to in game five and game six and perhaps game seven. I think, you know, when LeBron comes down the court and Hill sets the ball screen for him, then there's no need for an entry pass. There's no way to scram Rozier out of there. And there's really nothing that they can do other than, you know, hard double. And then, of course, LeBron's, you know, maybe the best passer in the world. So it's going to be, you know, that's going to be a tough thing to do. And they tried that a couple of times, and he found Love, who found Korver on one of them. And I think there was one other one where he found Korver directly, or J.R. Smith directly. And so it's just what they do, what Boston does about that, whether it's, you know, whether they just decide to bring that hard double, or Rozier, you know, gets really physical and hopes that the referees don't call every single foul. It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, see how Boston deals with that.
Boston did try to put Rozier and J.R. Smith, the Cavs, I think, just kept going back to that. I think Hill's the guy you want doing that, and I think that is certainly something we're going to, I think if you look, to not look ahead too much of what they could see after this, I think there's, if they play Golden State, there's an interesting wrinkle of where Golden State might put Curry that could make that can make this a little bit interesting. You might see a version of that, and what Houston would do might be a little bit different as well, because I think the Cavs would probably try to target Harden. But I think what you're going to see Boston do is probably try to keep scramming, would be my guess, right? Like, you're going to try to make it be J.R. Smith instead of George Hill, because it's just not as dangerous, and the volatility of J.R. could be an issue. The Cavs, I think, have the counters they're going to have is they're going to, I think, do some stretching out of the post-ups. You saw them do this a little bit where James was coming out farther away from the hoop. He was posting up farther away. So if Rozier has to scram and they're going to try to do a swap out, he has to cover a lot of ground. And like, there's only two guys on the team that are really capable of making those really good passes out of the post. That would be LeBron, obviously, and Kevin Love. And it's most dangerous with LeBron. But I don't know how much Boston really can do to take advantage of this. I don't know if that's their strategy, or if there is another counter. Maybe Brad Stevens will have something up his sleeve, even with the sort of thin roster he has right now. But I think this is something you're going to see a lot of in Game 5, Game 6. And if the Cavs do play, I think you're going to see a version of this. If the Cavs do advance, whoever they play next, I think some of what they're doing here really is going to be a key to their offense going forward. It might be less effective. Both those teams are a little deeper with different types of defensive talent. But I think this is just something the Cavs have found that I'm a little surprised they hadn't before, but I think how effective it's been and what the weak spot they found is a different version of the weak spots they've attacked the last couple seasons.
Yeah, but I, you know, if we want to get into whether it's the Warriors or the Rockets, I think with the Warriors definitely attacking Steph Curry, you know, we've seen the Rockets do that. I think that would be an interesting parallel to Terry Rozier in terms of his defensive talent, but the you know, if they're going to go after James Harden, James Harden's a lot stronger than Rozier and Curry, and I'm not sure, you know, maybe against LeBron, because LeBron can have success against anybody. But you know, if they're switching Love or Thompson or Green onto James Harden and expecting that to be an advantage matchup, that's, I think they're going to be mistaken there.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I just think he's the one guy. I think just if you're looking at replicating it, he's the only guy that you would do it against Houston. Like Chris Paul, it would be a weird person to do it against. I think the one critique I would have is I don't think Jeff Green should just be used in that way at all. You know, I think like that's just sort of more than what he's capable of. Thompson really should only do it in flashes. And I think when he took advantage of it, he has to make very quick decisions. The more he dribbles, the more he tries to do a traditional back down his defender post up, just the less effective he's going to be. I think he was at his best in game four when he was just catching the ball and dunking or taking one dribble and putting up a layup. When he's making these quick, efficient movements, I think that's when Thompson's at his best. Speaking of Thompson, he has been resurgent in these playoffs so far. Before we get into just how good he's been and what he's done against Horford, on a scale of like 1 to 10, with 10 being obviously the most surprised, how surprised are you that Thompson has, since Game 7 of the Pacers series, frankly, been this player and been so good for the Cavs?
I mean, it's you know, if you watch the regular season, especially down the end, it's really, you have to be incredibly surprised that Thompson's even back on the floor, that they even gave him a shot, especially as, you know, at the the interesting parallel here, the interesting thing here with Boston is that they're playing this five-out system with Horford popping to the perimeter, and you would think that that would sort of negate a lot of what Thompson does best. But really, that this is the perfect sort of opportunity for him to come in. He can really contain Rozier on those pick and rolls, and then get back out to Horford in a way that Love can't. And it's really interesting the way that sort of dichotomy. You would think that a five-out system would indicate that the Cavs need to go smaller, but actually going bigger is what's really helped them. And I think that's, you know, that's what Thompson brings to the table in terms of his quickness defensively. You know, his defensive IQ is probably underrated, you know, just because people don't quite see what he can do on that front. I think his positioning and his ability to read the game has really improved over the last few years. And he's done a great job in this series for sure.
Thompson is, I think, what the Cavs have really been searching for all season. I think just you can look at Kevin Love's comments on playing the five all season. You can hit little hints of his varying comfortability with it. He was obviously there. You can go back to the beginning of the season and see how uncomfortable he was with it. You could look at the middle of the season where he seemed to accept it a little bit. You could definitely see it was something Ty Lue had to kind of convince him to do. And I don't know where you fall on the what you think about Love as a five. I think it has its benefits, obviously, and certainly against centers like Baines, I think it can be really useful. There are also downsides defensively to it. He's not one of these fives that can shoot the three that also can, you know, protect the rim or get switched on a pick and rolls. There are clear limitations for him in that regard. And the Cavs, I would also just argue, don't necessarily have the personnel didn't have time to implement the personnel they ended up getting to really maximize that as well, right? Like, I just don't know if Jeff Green is the small ball four you want next to a spacey five. I don't know if that quite works, especially if, you know, LeBron's not a great shooter and you're not getting shooting or consistent play from other positions. If you don't have a point guard until you got George Hill, that could really orchestrate it. And this team didn't have the time to implement these type of sets. But I think I think Tristan just felt like worn down all year. I think worn down from those playoff runs. That's my pet theory with him, that he was just continuously worn down by those finals runs. I think it's just frankly remarkable that he has been this good, and it's come at a time where I don't know where they are if he's not this. You could look at Korver's season and wonder where they are without him. Love, obviously, when he got jerked around a little bit, got hurt, but was an all-star this year, has been mostly very good. LeBron's obviously been LeBron. When you look at this team right now, where they're at, I do not know if they're... I think it's very fair to say that they are not at all in the series on the verge of maybe winning a game in Boston, of coming back from 2-0, whatever, without Tristan Thompson being this. And I don't think there's a way they beat Boston without him doing what he's doing.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I don't think you can understate how big of an impact he's had on this playoff series. I think he's very much, you know, he's the one who's gotten their defense sort of back on track. Obviously the Celtics have missed some very easy shots at the rim and stuff, but you know, it's the defensive effort, the defensive rotations, the communication, of course, has been just so much more improved with Thompson out there, you know, and even a little bit with Larry Nance out there. But really, it's been Tristan Thompson who has really elevated the Cavaliers defense to a level where, you know, that they just can't get when Love is the center. Obviously, Love being the center opens up the floor a little bit more and brings a lot of offensive benefits. But like you said, those offensive benefits might be mitigated by the rest of the Cavaliers. I mean, especially when you have, you're going to have LeBron and Korver and J.R. Smith and Love, but that fifth guy has to be somebody who can space the floor. And George Hill's play has been, you know, sort of up and down, and obviously they're getting nothing out of Clarkson and Hood. And so that now you're looking at like Jeff Green, and you know, how big is a lineup really, or how small is a lineup if Jeff Green is playing the four, you know, and LeBron is playing the three, and it's just not as, you know, it's not as a coherent a strategy as it would be if as they are when they go big and they have a coherent, this is how we're going to defend, and this is, you know, we're going to run everything through LeBron, and he, you know, his mid-range jump shooting has been good enough to where he can, he can basically sustain, you know, his excellence from the mid-range, and it doesn't hurt their offense as much having Thompson out there when he can shoot like that.
when you look at Nance, he reinserted himself into the series in Game 3. He obviously got his first real minutes of the playoffs in that game. He had another, I thought he was better in Game 4 than he was in Game 3. He played in Game 2 as well. He has the same issues with Thompson where he doesn't make their spacing any better. You pointed this out, that he has this Dirk style. LeBron has this Dirk style jumper working away that doesn't require a lot of spacing to go in. The Cavs are sort of making this work without the same amount of space they've had in their last 3 years when they had Kyrie, and they maybe had a little bit more shooting, and they're now just basically relying on Kyle Korver to make threes and JR to be consistent, which is an incredibly insane thing to sort of bank on. But Nance, what do you make of Nance coming back after not really playing in the playoffs and playing the way he has? He hasn't, I think, just been serviceable. I thought in Game 4 in particular, he made some real impact plays. He had, I think, 2 3-point plays. He had a really nice steal when he got switched on to Marcus Smart. He's looked a lot more like the guy that they got right when he came over and was the best player coming out of the first couple games of that trade. He hasn't looked like that all the time. Obviously, I think that hamstring injury really did hamper him, but what do you make of how he's been able to reinsert himself into the Cavs' rotation? What, now that it's down to basically 8 guys?
Yeah, I think that's been a really interesting part of it. I think it allows them to play sort of a consistent style throughout the game because they're always going to have a center on the floor. You know, they've been able to sort of settle in on both ends of the floor, really. But you know, and they're using Nance and they're using Thompson in smart ways offensively. You know, they use them as dribble handoff outlets in a certain set that they run for Kyle Korver. You know, especially Nance, who, you know, has this sort of sneaky quickness offensively. Like we talked about this when he first joined the Cavs, and they rolled him out there for the first few games, and he really gelled with the team. He just has this sort of way of positioning himself and quickly getting in from one action to the next. I think that's his biggest thing offensively, which is kind of a weird, weird overall skill to have as your best skill. But he gets from screen to screen. If he has to set 2 screens in the same action, he moves from screen to screen very quickly. He moves, you know, sort of fluidly, and the offense can flow when he's on the floor in a way that a lot of centers sort of muck things up. And so I think that's sort of a soft skill that he has that you can't really point to and be like, oh yeah, that shows up in the box score here, but it helps the he's more of a lubricant for the overall offense than he is somebody who's obviously going to get you a bunch of points and stuff like that.
Him and Thompson, I think, have both been pretty efficient on offense, or at least if efficient is not the right word, it's taking advantage of these opportunities they have to take advantage of. They're getting dunks when they need to. They're not really taking many bad shots. They were better at this in Game 3, but were still good at it in Game 4. Nance, I think you pointed out something right about his screening. I think, actually, until these playoffs, I was not a particularly big fan of his screening. It's one of the things that I thought made Tristan a more valuable player than him, was that Tristan sets these very physical, like, bumping screens. Nance wouldn't always do that. Now, he's actually, I think, gotten better at that since he's come over. I don't know if that is... I need to ask him about this, but I don't know if it's something that Thompson is sort of forced into learn, or that the coaches have harped on him on, or if it's a variety of things, but he's actually putting his body into guys on screens. And there is like some value in him moving, right? Like the Cavs do not run a system or anything like that necessarily relies on the Warriors type ball movement or what Boston does with screening, or other teams do in terms of jetting guys around. But they have guys that just sort of know where to go and are smart about it. Korver's great at this. Nance is, as you pointed out, good at this. Thompson's good at this. The role players, as much as they will run certain sets and have guys set screens for certain types of actions, pin downs, what have you, the guys just sort of need to move in the right spot, and some of it sort of works because they have LeBron and because Kevin Love is also very good, but Nance just sort of fits in that way. And I think you're right that it does give them an identity. It's not a very modern identity in playing these 2 centers, but it helps that these guys aren't necessarily 7-foot slow-footed behemoths either.
Yeah, I think, and that's the key point, especially defensively, is they're not losing anything by having those guys on the floor on either end of the floor, and on offense. They, you know, they're finding their way to make their shots, to sort of get in these little duck-ins and dunks inside when LeBron drives, and, you know, just getting getting out of the way when LeBron has it going against against a good matchup, you know, especially with Nance. He's sort of, because when he plays most of the time, Baines is also on the floor. He's finding this good sort of happy medium between setting a hard screen and getting the ball handler open because Baines is hanging back on pick and rolls, and sometimes slipping out of those and getting into something else because, again, Baines is so far back that if you can get Nance the ball at the free throw line, he's wide open, not necessarily to hit that shot, but to give the ball again to somebody else, go set another hard screen, and then the offense is moving in a way that it doesn't always move when Love is out there, especially because, you know, as much spacing as Love gives you as the center, he sort of spaces out and is not as strong a screener as Nance and Thompson are.
Are you concerned about how Love has looked the last two games at all? He's been the one guy in these two wins that I think hasn't quite gelled for foul trouble in game four. I'm not really quite sure what the issue was in game three. And the Cavs have said that him and Jeff Green are both dealing with some kind of small injury right now. Be it, I don't know how serious it actually is or what that means. They're not going to be listed on the injury report. But, I mean, are you concerned at all about how Love has looked these last two games where the Cavs have won?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be a little bit concerned, especially with some of his post-ups have not, you know, he's not playing with the physicality. I mean, even against Rozier a little bit, he wasn't getting there. But, you know, when they post him up against Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum, like those aren't, you know, it should be an advantage for them. But he's not, you know, I think something you said earlier about how Love and LeBron are sort of the two high-level passers out of the post. I'm not sure Kevin Love's really that well, you know, that great of a passer out of the post, especially, you know, when they sort of throw him these post-ups early in the game. And, you know, those are his offensive possessions to use. I think he knows that. I think everybody knows that at this point.
Very stagnant when the ball gets down to him in there. It's a very good point on your part that when he gets the ball in those positions, things sort of stop. And if there was some more dynamic movement off ball, and maybe he knows, and maybe he just wants that, mentally needs that shot. Maybe it just, he feels like he needs to take those opportunities when they come up. But maybe maybe you're right. Like maybe there, if there is some more movement, and maybe if there is some buy-in there, maybe that's a little bit different.
Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, giving him post-ups to get him going and to get him into the game, you know, that's a good idea, and that's something that has worked for big men for as long as there have been big men. But, you know, it comes at the cost of, like, those are pretty low efficiency possessions, and, you know, if it's sort of a feedback loop of Love doesn't pass out because those are some of the only possessions he gets, and then nobody moves on the perimeter, so then Love doesn't pass out, and it just sort of, you know, it's sort of a cyclical, you know, downturn, and I think that we're seeing a lot of that when they throw him the ball early in games and in these matchups that it's not, you know, those aren't necessarily advantage matchups for him, you know, especially when, you know, even if he gets Rozier there, they're scramming him out really well, and they're not, you know, they're not always finding the shooter on the backside. You know, I think Hill did that once for J.R. Smith, but for the most part, they were throwing it into Love, and he's just not particularly, you know, great at working in the post, even against somebody who's, you know, slightly smaller than him. He really needs a very, you know, a large mismatch in order to really, you know, take advantage of that.
I think if he is being aggressive and is putting that shoulder down a little bit and bumping when he gets Rozier, but also Brown and Tatum, I think he should be able to score there. I feel if he's doing that and his first two moments in those post-ups are him being initiating contact and then going up for a shot, I feel a little bit better about them. But if he's being a little weak about it or is just going to settle for that 16-footer, I agree, it's not quite as good of a possession. But he was against Baines. I also think he should just try to cook Baines every time because I think there's an advantage. It's like the one guy that Love just is going to be quicker than, even if Baines is a lot bigger and could block him if he moves his feet well. And Baines was pretty good in game four. The last thing we're going to talk about is how the Cavs have gone to this 8-man rotation. It's not, I think, particularly surprising that Clarkson and Hood are both out of the rotation at this point. Hood did not play in game four. Clarkson played a whopping 4 minutes and was pretty bad in those 4 minutes. You and I have hit this ad nauseum, and I think anyone who's familiar with our particular takes on basketball knows that these guys we're not fans of these guys. We're not necessarily fans of what they do on the court or their aesthetic or just how they feel like they impact a good team. Is there any downside to to not playing these guys? And do you think there's a concern in an eight-man rotation for this Cavs team?
I mean, the concern would be that they'll get tired out, and, you know, especially if this series goes seven, and if they're, you know, obviously they're going to be trying to win the championship. That goes without saying when in the next round, you know, if they're going to be in that next series, which, you know, some partisan people, including me, don't totally expect them to be, even if they make it there. But if they, you know, if they're going to go seven,
they're just, I'm yeah. gonna, I think they're screwed. It takes LeBron like being a god for seven games, and like George Hill playing like the best seven games of his life, and Kevin Love playing the best seven games of his life, I think, for the Cavs to like get in with Golden State or Houston, there's just a lot of deficiencies. I don't know how this roster answers them.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be able to do it. But if in the grand scheme of things, the way that they win a championship this year is, you know, they got to get through Boston another two games at least, and then it's going to take them six or seven games to get through, you know, if they were to win over Houston or Golden State. And that's, you know, that's a lot of, you know, that's just a lot of minutes for the guys, especially if they're only playing an eight-man rotation. Obviously, they'll have more rest as they get into the finals if they make it through Boston. So, you know, it's something that they can do. It's obviously, you know, LeBron can play 48 almost. You know, we saw him, you know, cramp up in the Indiana game seven, but he can play 44 minutes, you know, 44, 45 minutes a game. So I think it's you know, that's doable, but it's the rest of those guys and whether you can get consistent minutes to, you know, to add everything up so that they don't have to play Clarkson and Hood. That's, you know, it's an important sort of aspect to it where, you know, if you have a bad Larry Nance game, then you have to, you know, you think about trying to go small, and then you have to play Hood or Clarkson as one of those guys. But, you know, I mean, I think we've talked about it before, but, you know, Chetty Osman seems like a decent solution, you know, especially if they were to make it through to the next game the next series, that they would have to, you know, they would want to try to, you know, integrate him into the rotation. But it seems at this point like it would shock me at this point if they were to, you know, bring him in after more than a month of him basically not seeing the floor at all.
It would be a little surprising at this point if they did it. It feels like if Ty was going to go to Jetty, it would have happened. I think there have been opportunities where it would happen. Like if Hood was, you know, going to get benched after he refused to go in the game, or Clarkson was going to be benched, like he to me should be the next guy up. But I wonder. I don't. It's obviously there's no way for us to predict if we're going to get this scenario. But if Korver and or J.R. Smith get in serious foul trouble in a game, which considering who they're going to be, you know, playing in this round and could be playing in the next round is a distinct possibility. There's just a chance that they have to play more than eight guys, or if Ty just plays Jeff Green 35 minutes, and neither, you know, playing Jeff Green 35 minutes is not gonna end well. And I just sort of feel like Osman's just the more interesting option. There's obviously limitations there. He's a rookie that can't really handle the ball. His three-point shot's a little inconsistent at this point in time, but he does run the floor well, and he does try, and he does play defense. So I if you're looking at just variables of what you're going to provide, that value of just trying and like not and running the floor and not like hijacking possessions with bad shots just seems like it might be more useful, but you're right. I think it seems like the ship has sailed on that one. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the pod. And again, just give a plug real quick for everywhere you write and the Patreon you have set up for your new site.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at JG Siegel. You can find my Cavs writing at Fear of the Sword, Atlanta Hawks at Peachtree Hoops, Portland Trail Blazers at Blazers Edge. And then you can find everything else on the rest of the league over at earlybirdrights.com, which is, you know, I'm about a month into working for that site. That's a one-man show over there. I launched that site about a month ago now, and it's, you know, it's going pretty well. I have, you know, playoff game breakdowns, and as soon as we get into free agency, I've got cap sheets for every team and every signing that happens. I'm going to be updating those cap sheets as quickly as possible. You know, I think I can pretty much get them up there within about 5 minutes of a signing being announced, which is quicker and more accurate than anybody else out there, not to name names, but I'm, you know, hopeful that I'm better than pretty much everybody else. So, you know, I think that's that it's something that a lot of people liked from me last year when I was posting them on Twitter. And so now I've got a home for them so that you don't have to ask me, oh, what is the cap sheet for the Cleveland Cavaliers now that LeBron is re-signed for the max? You can just go on the website and look at it. And so I think that's the main draw for the cap stuff. You can, you know, you can, if you really like what I'm doing over at Early Bird Rights, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/earlybirdrights. You know, we've got, I've got a few different rewards set up there if you're interested in supporting me.
Yeah, if you want to make Jeff like write a player breakdown of like Ante Zizic or something, that's you can do it by supporting him on Patreon, and he'll be really mad at you, but he'll be grateful for the support. Again, go do that. Patreon's a great way to support people, and you're going to hear Jeff on this pod again. So read his piece in the show notes. So that is going to be it for today's show. Again, go on iTunes, leave that 5-star rating and review for Locked On Cavaliers. Be sure to support the podcast while following us on Twitter and Facebook at Locked On Cavs. Find me on Twitter and Facebook at CWM Rights. Support Fear the Sword as well. And again, check out Jeff's Patreon at patreon.com/earlybirdrights. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Manning, your host of Locked On Cavaliers, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.